Hey everybody, it's Brock Falk, and I want to thank you for listening to this message from Heritage Church of Christ. We would be thrilled to share more content like this with you and make it easy for you to share it with others. You can find more messages like this on our podcast, or you can download our smartphone app by searching for Heritage Church of Christ in your app store. But most importantly, I hope this message encourages you to take a next step toward a thriving relationship with Jesus. Enjoy. So here's a question for you. Have you ever wanted something so badly that you became completely unaware that you didn't even need that thing? In other words, have you ever become so fixated on something you wanted that it never even crossed your mind that the thing you wanted might be useless to you or might even be harmful if you got it? Without us even conversing about it, I can tell that your answer is yes. You've done this. I've done this. We've all done this. At some point along the way in each of our lives, we've become so enamored, so obsessed, so infatuated with something or someone that we completely ignored what the wiser, more objective people around us tried to tell us, and we weren't listening, that the thing we wanted wasn't going to do us any good. It's really easy to see this when we look back at our younger selves with a few years of separation. In fact, I've got lots of examples from my own life, and most of them are really embarrassing, but maybe you can relate to a time in your preteen years or as a teenager when there was a fashion item that you just had to have. For me, it was a pair of Oakley sunglasses back in the early 1990s. See, they had these wraparound glasses called M-frames that all the cool kids and the star athletes were wearing, and I wanted those things so bad. But they cost over $100, and that seemed way out of reach for me, so I resorted to begging my parents to buy them for me. I asked for them every time we went to the mall, which sounds really old to say. I asked for them as a birthday gift. I asked for them as a reward for good grades. I was riveted by these sunglasses, and I just had to have some. And my parents simply would not buy them for me. And I remember being so disappointed about it. But you see, there was this one inconvenient truth that my parents knew, and I was completely unaware of. That at 11 years old, I was not a wearer of sunglasses. See, I already owned cheaper sunglasses, and I never used them. And of course, you could buy cheaper sunglasses that looked a lot like the Oakley M-frames. But I wasn't hounding my parents about buying those. And what much wiser parents saw that I couldn't see was that I was desperate to have this thing that I didn't need. And what I really wanted had nothing to do with sunglasses, which I didn't need, and everything to do with a feeling, which I thought I needed. And the thing is, we've all done this multiple times in our lives. We've all done this, and we've all watched as other people around us have done this. In fact, it's a problematic reality that it's easier to see this happening in someone else than it is to see it in ourselves. It's easier to notice when someone else is chasing something that won't actually satisfy them, something they don't really need. We've seen this in athletes who have chased a title or a championship that they knew they just had to have, but what they really wanted wasn't a trophy or a ring or a medal. That shiny piece of metal wasn't what they were really chasing. Deep down, they wanted something they thought that trophy would provide. It could be that they wanted to be admired. Perhaps they wanted to be remembered. Perhaps they wanted to be famous, or maybe they wanted to be rich. And they thought the trophy would provide deeper meaning. And the real danger comes when that pursuit, that craving that we have, becomes so strong that it becomes the top priority, more important than any other commitments or ethics or promises. And so we've seen athletes so desperate to win that they cheated their way to the top. And it's easy to see this happening in someone else. It's so easy to recognize when someone else is chasing the wrong thing and making compromises to get what they think they're after. But it's not so easy to see this in ourselves. And that ought to make us pause. Because I'm convinced that the most tragic way to spend a lifetime would be to chase the wrong thing. Thomas Merton said, "People may spend their whole lives climbing the ladder of success, only to find, once they reach the top, that the ladder is leaning against the wrong wall." And wouldn't that be heartbreaking? Wouldn't it be tragic if you spent your whole life with all of your time and your energy and your resources and your attention pursuing the wrong goal? I don't want that to happen to you. So last week we kicked off a series of messages that we've called Trapped. And we're talking about what happens when the wrong things become the priority in our lives. We're talking about what happens when we devote ourselves to the wrong pursuit. And we're talking about how to direct our lives toward what actually matters most. And last week we looked at an ancient story. It's recorded in the Old Testament portion of the Bible. It's a story about a time when a whole nation of people determined that God must have forgotten about them. And so they built an idol, a statue of a calf. And they bowed down to that idol in worship, even though God had commanded them explicitly not to worship anything except God alone. And that golden calf idea, it seems pretty primitive to us. Most of us can't imagine bowing down and giving our allegiance to a statue. But in some ways, the ancient Israelites weren't so much different than we are. They were seeking security. They were trying to cope with their fear. They were looking for anything to take away their discomfort. They were trying to control their destiny. And the strategy that made the most sense to them was to appeal to the unseen forces that controlled their surroundings. Now, in modern times, our strategies look a little bit different. We don't look for salvation from a statue the way some ancient cultures seemed to do. But like the Israelites, we know what it's like to worry about security, right? We know what it's like to be afraid. We have the same aversion to discomfort that they had. We don't like feeling powerless. And the question that each one of us has got to wrestle with is, what do you turn to when you feel vulnerable, afraid, uncomfortable, or weak? Because even if you've never built a statue to worship, the truth is that every culture has its own idols. So I want to show you another episode from the story of the Israelites. And this episode happened about 40 years after the golden calf story that we studied last week. By this time, God had protected and provided for the Israelites through a series of military battles, and God had given them a territory to call home. And at a gathering of their entire nation, when their nomadic days of wandering were coming to an end and they were entering a time of peaceful settlement in their new homeland, Israel's leader Joshua reminded them of everything that God had done and every danger that God had carried them through. Joshua gave them this challenge, and it's recorded in the book of Joshua, chapter 24, beginning in verse 14. And Joshua says, "Now fear the Lord and serve Him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your ancestors worshipped beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt and serve the Lord." Joshua was challenging them to get rid of the idols of their ancestors, the concocted beings that they had sought after for power and security and fertility and comfort in the past. And we don't know if the Israelites were holding on to actual statues at that point, but the statues weren't the point. It was what the statues represented. It was the human tendency to grasp for anything that could give a sense of control or power over one's destiny. And this command, the command given to the Israelites, was to trust in God's provision, to trust in God's protection, rather than grasping at distractions that were powerless to satisfy. And Joshua gave the people a choice. He said in verse 15, "But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." Now Joshua was drawing a line in the sand. He was challenging the people to decide right then and there where they would put their trust. And initially the people agreed. They said, far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. And then they go on retelling the story. It was the Lord our God Himself who brought us and our parents up out of Egypt from that land of slavery and performed these great signs before our eyes. He protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And the Lord drove out before us all the nations, including the Amorites who lived in the land. We too will serve the Lord because He is our God. So in this verse, the people make their choice and they choose to serve the Lord, the God of Moses and Joshua who had led them out of Egypt. But I want you to notice something about the options that Joshua presented to them. The options he gave them were worship the Lord or worship the gods of the ancestors. But notice there was no option C. There was no none of the above. There was no option to worship nothing at all. And I'm not sure if Joshua was just a product of his own time and those were the only options he knew. Or maybe he was keenly aware of human nature. But I want to suggest to you that every human being is a worshiper. It's hardwired into us. And that doesn't mean that every human is religious. You and I both know people who would reject that label. But if you strip away the religious association that goes with this word, worship is simply our instinctive inclination to put our hope in something and then chase after it. Worship is what we do when we've identified what we want and then we make sacrifices to get it. A famous writer, David Foster Wallace, said this in a commencement address at a college graduation ceremony. He said, "In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship." And if Wallace was correct, then you have a choice to make. And it's a choice not unlike the choice that Joshua gave to the Israelites. The choice you have to make is whether you'll serve the Lord or whether you'll serve one of the other gods of our culture. This is the choice. It's the choice that decides which wall the ladder of your life is leaning against. And this is a decision that has implications for every other area of your life. Because there's something else that's true about worship, and I'm very grateful to Pastor Kyle Eidelman for helping me put this into words. Your life will ultimately be centered around what you care about most. And the decision you make about what to worship will impact all your other decisions. In fact, the object of your worship will determine your future and define your life. That means if you decide to worship accumulation, if your attitude is whoever dies with the most toys wins, then your whole life will be focused on accumulating. And if you decide to worship entertainment, if your attitude is I'm not here for a long time, but I'm here for a good time, then you'll spend your life seeking the next thrill. And those are just a few examples. And in fact, we're going to spend the next few messages in this series identifying some of the most common objects of worship in our modern culture. But what I hope becomes clear to you today is that the object of your worship becomes the motivation for your life. It's like the choice between a train that's heading east and a train that's heading west. Your entire life's direction depends on the decision that you make about what you're going to worship. This is the narrative hinge that determines the remainder of your story. But I want to tell you how the Israelites' story ended up. You see, the very next book in the Old Testament, the book of Judges, tells us that the Israelites served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things that the Lord had done for Israel. But then Joshua died. And the generation of Israelites who said, "Far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods," they passed away too. And Judges says in chapter 2, verse 10, that after that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who neither who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. And then the Israelites did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and they served the Baals. Those are some local idol gods. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors who had brought them out of Egypt, and they followed and worshiped various gods of the people around them. And unfortunately, that was the pattern. For most of the next 400 years, the Israelites would waver back and forth. Sometimes they worshiped the Lord. Sometimes they worshiped the gods and the idols of their culture. Sometimes they tried to do both, but it was like trying to stand on two moving trains at one time. Instead of giving God their whole hearts, they hedged their bets. They pledged their allegiance to God, and then they secretly worshiped their borrowed and concocted idols just in case God didn't come through. They looked at their idols the way you'd look at an insurance policy. But the policy premiums were stolen from the Lord who had brought them out of Egypt. And a few generations later, Israel gave up on worshiping the Lord altogether, and they quickly discovered that their ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. You see, what happened to Israel, and what can easily happen to you and me, is what I want to call worship drift. And worship drift is when our devotion strays away from trusting in God and strays back toward trusting ourselves. And each one of us, we have our own unique weaknesses. We have our own predispositions that we tend toward when we're feeling down or when we're lonely or when we're anxious or when we feel powerless. We each have our own false gods that call out to us when we're tired of waiting on God's timing. And wisdom tells us we should learn to recognize the false priorities and the wrong walls that we're tempted to lean our ladders against. But as we wrap up today, I want to leave you with a hint of good news. And the good news is that when you're tired or powerless or lonely or anxious, and when you've been trying to make it on your own, the good news is that you are not alone. In fact, exactly when you're tired, precisely when you're worn out from trying to make your own way, Jesus has these words for you. Come to me, all you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Let me teach you, because I'm humble and gentle at heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy to bear, and the burden I give you is light. You see, part of the beauty of the God that Jesus knows is that this God knows and understands our weaknesses. God isn't asking for exorbitant sacrifices or impossible perfection. God just wants your heart. God is jealous for your devotion. God is looking for your trust. And it's only when our lives are oriented toward God that we can be sure our lives aren't being wasted. So where's your life heading? What is your life oriented toward? What do you really want? Where are you going? If you aren't sure, maybe we could decide together. And if you know where you're heading and it's not where you want to go, maybe we could talk about how to turn around.